It's time to take the quiz.
5 questions, 5 minutes a day, 5 days a week.
Take the quiz every weekday at thequiz.fox and then listen to the quiz podcast to find out how you did.
Play, share, and of course, listen to the quiz at thequiz.fox.
I'm Sandra Smith.
I'm Trey Gowdy.
I'm Shannon Bream, and this is the Fox News Rundown.
Tuesday, January 31st, 2023. I'm Dave Anthony. After laying low for a while, former President Trump was back out campaigning for his old job over the weekend.
We did not hear a lot about what Trump would be doing if he won the presidency again in 2024, and I think that's one of the biggest challenges he faces.
I'm Jessica Rosenthal. Multiple investigations are underway into the Memphis police beating of Tyre Nichols, and 5 officers were charged with murder within days of his death. Video of the brutal encounter was released just prior to the weekend, shocking the nation.
These guys were on body cam. They know everything they're doing is recorded. And yet they did not have any trepidations about behaving the way they did. That tells me there was no fear of their overhead. Nobody's going to look at the video to say, what are you guys doing?
And I'm Tommy Lahren. I've got the final word on the Fox News Rundown.
It's been more than 2 months since former President Trump announced he's running again. And he's finally back out campaigning.
We are going to take back our country and we'll take back the White House and we're going to straighten out the United States of America. Okay?
That was in New Hampshire, where a recent poll has the former president trailing Florida Governor Ron DeSantis, who many speculate will challenge Trump for the Republican nomination. Though numerous national polls give the former president a comfortable double-digit lead over DeSantis and any other possible GOP challenger.
Joe Biden has put America on the fast track to ruin and destruction, and we will ensure that he does not receive 4 more years.
That was hours later at a second Trump campaign event on Saturday in South Carolina. Josh Krausar was at the early one in New Hampshire.
The biggest takeaway is that this was one of the few Trump campaign events I can remember that wasn't a huge rally.
Josh is senior politics correspondent for Axios and a Fox News Radio political analyst.
It wasn't filled with thousands of screaming fans and supporters at a major venue. It was at a fairly small high school in an auditorium. Trump was he actually announced his appearance within the week of this event, which is the state party annual meeting, a long scheduled event where they elect a new chairman, elect a lot of the statewide officials. And Trump didn't get the kind of applause, didn't get the kind of enthusiastic greeting that you would normally expect from one of those big rallies. Certainly the room supported Trump. They liked what he did as president. But when you talk to the Republican state legislators, state office holders, as I did, there was a lot of mixed opinion, and a sizable number of Republicans in New Hampshire, at least, said that they would prefer someone else to run for president and be the nominee for the Republicans rather than Donald Trump.
It's interesting because when former President Trump announced his reelection campaign in November, trying to get the White House again, people criticized the long, meandering speech, saying he was low energy, which, of course, he used to say about Jeb Bush in 2016. Do you think it was low energy on Saturday?
Look, I won't go that far, but there weren't a whole lot of applause lines. There were, 3 or 4 applause lines and a 1-hour speech. It was more of a greatest hits recollection from his days as president, but not a whole lot of new material. You know, it was kind of like watching The Celebrity Apprentice season 8, where you're seeing the same old characters, the same old tricks, and it's getting a little bit old. There wasn't a whole lot of new policy proposals. He did unveil, an education proposal, taking on CRT, critical race theory, in the classrooms. That got a very strong response, a positive response. But by and large, it was just sort of a recollection of what he did as president. And a lot of the other Republicans looking to run are planning to talk about what they would do, how they would deal with the newfound challenges that this country faces. We did not hear a lot about what Trump would be doing if he won the presidency again in 2024. And I think that's one of the biggest challenges he faces.
In New Hampshire, there was that survey that came out the other day from UNH poll that had Florida Governor Ron DeSantis at 42%, 12 points ahead of former President Trump. Did you hear a lot of DeSantis talk when you were there?
What was notable is that aside from about 8 or 10 people outside of this high school with the Trump memorabilia and the Trump logos and all the, they were selling Trump merchandise. In the room itself, the people who were credentialed to appear at this convention, there was no presence of any kind of Trump 24 campaign other than Trump himself.
Okay.
By contrast, there was a super PAC supporting Ron DeSantis, not affiliated with the governor, but supporting his candidacy if he gets in the race. There was a booth there for Ron DeSantis. There was a cutout, a life-size cutout of Ron DeSantis that this group put in the front entrance of the auditorium. So you could see Ron DeSantis support everywhere. You know, I think some of it is genuine affection for the Florida governor, and some of it is looking for the alternative, the most electable alternative to Donald Trump. I mean, Republicans in New Hampshire in 2022 suffered losses across the ballot with these MAGA Trump-aligned candidates. And I think there are a lot of Trump supporters who just want to find Republicans that can win in a purple state like New Hampshire, that are more electable, and they're getting a little bit tired of all the losing that they've experienced in recent elections.
You know, the former president on Saturday, I mean, obviously Ron DeSantis is getting under his skin. He has said that if DeSantis runs for governor, it would be very disloyal. And he said that Ron DeSantis would not have been elected governor if it wasn't for him.
I'm not sure who's advising Trump on his political strategy. Clearly, DeSantis is shaping up to be his biggest rival for the 2024 nomination. But some of the biggest MAGA supporters like Ron DeSantis a whole lot. And I'm not sure if they really like the strategy that Trump has agreed upon to go after the Florida governor and trying to attack him this early in the process.
Yeah, I mean, he's trying to also say, listen, you know, Governor DeSantis is trying to claim that Florida was always open in COVID. He said that's not the case. They're trying to rewrite history. Florida was closed. Bars and restaurants were closed. Other Republican governors didn't go as far as he did. So he's really trying to go after him on what a lot of people see as DeSantis' strengths.
Yeah, well, you just touched upon one of the big fault lines that would occur in a primary between Trump and DeSantis, which is their respective policies when it came to COVID. And Trump is trying to make the case, I think inaccurately, that DeSantis shut down while Trump was calling for the country to be open. I think it was the reverse, if I remember my history from that period, that everyone in the country closed down at first, shut down because of the fears over COVID. But Florida was one of the first states to open up and to resist some of the more regulatory mandates that were in place throughout much of the country. So Trump is trying to rewrite some history because he understands that's one of DeSantis's appeals, that he was one of the first governors to open up his state, to open up schools, to really resist some of the public health measures that were taken throughout much of the country that ended up costing kids in terms of their education and businesses in terms of being able to get back on their footing. That's one of DeSantis's biggest selling points. It contrasts him with Donald Trump, who was side by side with Dr. Fauci in that early stage of the pandemic. And it's going to be one of the big political battle lines in 2024.
In South Carolina, there was a poll out the other day, the Trafalgar, that had the former president up ahead of Ron DeSantis by 15 points in South Carolina, where he also went over the weekend. Nikki Haley gets 12% in that poll in South Carolina. She gets 8% in third place in New Hampshire. The former president did say that he spoke to her and told her she should run if she wants to run for president. Is she running?
I think she is running. Everything I hear is that she may be one of the first Republicans outside of Trump to get into this race. One thing that's interesting from the polling is that in their respective home states, Governor Haley and former Governor Haley and Governor Sununu, Chris Sununu in New Hampshire, both really well to the back of the pack, even though they have won big elections for governor in their home states. So that shows you how big of a factor DeSantis is, how big of a factor Trump still is within the party.
National polls that have come up recently have Trump with big leads over DeSantis. There's an Emerson poll that had head-to-head Trump 44, Biden 41. That same poll has Biden slightly ahead of DeSantis. So that poll has Trump doing better and beating Joe Biden. You believe that?
Well, that's more a function of where Joe Biden is politically, which is, you know, not in the greatest of shape for a president entering the third year in office. You know, look, I think Trump could kind of repeat what he did in 2020, get close to President Biden. Maybe if there was a recession or some crisis in the country, that would be the path for Trump to win. It reflects a lot more antipathy towards Biden or lack of enthusiasm towards President Biden rather than any comeback for Donald Trump, whose own numbers throughout all these polls are still fairly low.
Now, President Biden has not formally announced he is running for re-election, but there are reports he's getting ready to do some big fundraising. And some thought his event last week on the economy in Virginia seemed like a campaign speech attacking Republicans.
What in God's name would the Americans give up the progress we've made for the chaos they're suggesting?
Days after he called GOP lawmakers fiscally demented.
They want to raise your gas prices. They want to cut taxes for billionaires.
One of the Democrats he beat in the 2020 race, Senator Elizabeth Warren, says
he should run again. Why? And he is running again because he has gotten a tremendous amount done.
She then raised eyebrows on Boston Public Radio when asked if she supports Vice President Harris also.
You know, I really want to defer to what makes Biden comfortable on his team.
Leading to some speculation Senator Warren may not want Harris as Biden's VP in a second term.
She later corrected herself, said that she supports Harris on the 2024 ticket, but it's a reflection that the fact that you wouldn't instinctively support the vice president of the country for re-election, you know, it shows you that there are a lot of Democrats privately that worry about Kamala Harris's political staying power. They look at her job approval numbers, 38% in the 538 average. It's just in very poor shape. And one of the reasons I think that Biden is so committed to running for re-election isn't just about Biden, but it's also about the fears that a lot of Democratic insiders have in that if he retired, decided to step down, you'd have a very vulnerable Harris in the top spot, and you'd have a possible civil war within the party between the progressives like Elizabeth Warren and the more moderate Democrats that also make up a pretty sizable chunk of the electorate. So the devil you know, or at least the guy who has a lot of vulnerabilities like Biden, but you know what they are, maybe end up be better for the Democrats than the problems that could come if Biden stepped aside and let a civil war within the Democratic Party over ideology take place.
But there's another thing I was thinking about on this same front. Being the running mate for President Biden in 2024 would be very appealing. His age, what if he doesn't finish a second term if he's reelected? Then that vice president takes over. For Elizabeth Warren, who wants the White House, wouldn't that be a pretty appealing gig?
Yeah, you know, I just don't see that because unless Harris voluntarily left the ticket, the notion that you would push off the first African-American woman, which Biden talks so much about playing identity politics and the decision to name Harris to the ticket, if you pushed her off the ticket for anyone, whether it's Warren or someone who has better political approval ratings, the cost would still be awfully, awfully high because a lot of African-American voters would view that as a snub.
There was a poll in New Hampshire where Pete Buttigieg is number one among Democratic voters, 5 points ahead of Biden, 5 points ahead of Warren, 8 points ahead of Sanders. Buttigieg and Bernie Sanders were neck and neck back in the 2020 primary. Joe Biden finished fifth. Could he possibly run as the transportation secretary against the sitting president? Would he even dream of it?
He's not going to run against Biden. I don't think it would. I don't think it would make a whole lot of sense. So, you know, there's no interest for Buttigieg to take on Biden directly. Now, if Biden decided not to run, would Buttigieg seriously consider a campaign? I think that's possible. But Buttigieg has a lot of overlap in terms of his political interests with how the president does.
Josh Crosshair, senior politics correspondent at Axios, Fox News Radio political analyst. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks a lot.
Hey, it's Clay Travis. Join me for Outkick, the show, as we dive deep into a mix of topics. New episodes available Monday to Friday on your favorite podcast platform and watch directly on outkick.com/watch.
This is Tommy Lahren with your Fox News commentary coming up.
A sixth officer involved in the death of Tyre Nichols in Memphis has been suspended, though police did not immediately reveal the role he played. Five officers who were fired after the confrontation have been charged with second-degree murder, aggravated assault, and aggravated kidnapping by the Shelby County DA. The Tennessee Bureau of Investigation said Tyre was killed due to use of force injuries. Their agency is investigating as well. And the U.S. Attorney's Office in Tennessee says they've opened a criminal civil rights investigation. Shelby County DA Steve Mulroy said in announcing the charges,
"We did work quickly to expedite this investigation because of the extraordinary nature of the case. Compared to the average investigation and prosecution decisions in a case like this, we worked swiftly, but also fairly."
The head of the Tennessee Bureau of Investigation, David Rausch, said what happened here does not reflect proper policing, that this was wrong and criminal. Protests erupted over the weekend after video was released Friday evening of the police body cam footage of the beating of Tyre, who'd been pulled over, officers said, for reckless driving, though how Tyre was driving has not yet been established. His father, Rodney Wells, earlier told reporters, along with the family attorneys, Tyre had no guns or drugs on him.
"So I just wanted to share that in case anybody tried to throw that out there, why did he run? Because we've heard that on social media. He ran because he was scared for his life. He was trying to get home to his mother and father."
Nichols was a 29-year-old father to a 4-year-old. His mother said he loved skateboarding and taking pictures of sunsets. He has no known criminal record and worked with his father at FedEx. Investigators not only worked rather quickly to initiate these multiple investigations, but they've been in touch with the Nichols family through it as well.
"My understanding is that a sixth officer was just suspended."
Paul Morrow was a retired NYPD inspector, attorney, and founder of OpsDesk.org.
That officer is apparently not indicted yet, so they'll have to impanel a grand jury. But right now, that's the point of the spear. That's the criminal case. And that'll be complicated because of the five current indicted officers. You have at least two of them who have secured their own lawyers who are beginning to put out talking points, trying to pare away their culpability away from the rest of the officers. So you're going to see the five officers' interests diverge here. Now, one of the things that might occur is the DA may decide to cooperate one of the less culpable officers if the DA decides that the case needs or warrants that. That can be a double-edged sword. People don't like the optic on that, people outside the criminal justice system. But those of us who have worked in criminal justice for a long time understand the necessity of it and why sometimes it is a deal worth making. So again, that's the primary and that's the district attorney's office. The other case that's going on from the Tennessee Bureau of Investigation, what's the value of that if we already have a criminal case? The point of that case is going to be, in my view, to do an overview of what has been going on inside Memphis PD and particularly the Scorpion unit, why the unit was constituted as it was, what its protocols were, what its supervision was, training, how the officers who went into it were vetted, et cetera. And I think what they're really going to end up doing is a top to bottom review of the department. I think it's going to end up being a sort of systemic review of the Memphis PD writ large. I don't see how they can avoid that, frankly, because a unit like this, which was rolled out with a lot of fanfare, you know, there was no shortage of people at the top being willing to name check the unit up to the mayor. The mayor in his state of the city last year pointedly stated that the Scorpion unit had been stood up and that it was making great inroads into what it was tasked to do. So if you're going to own the successes of this thing, you have to own its failures as well. So I'm sure the vast, vast majority of Memphis PD are hardworking women and men who showed up, took the job for the right reason. Nobody goes into police work for money. But the bottom line is this is what they're going to be known for now. And it's going to be very hard for those officers going forward. And the only way to really assuage that is to firewall the department off from this event. You really need a full-scale rebranding here. And unfortunately, the way that that's done generally, history has taught us, is the top person has to go.
But I think, Paul, the question is, you know, a lot of There's been a lot of talk over the past several years, right, about units like the Scorpion Unit and other agencies, right, aggressive units stood up to tackle maybe higher crime spots. Is this just about Memphis? When you talk about going through and looking at the Memphis PD, because there are people, as we've heard, all over the country for years who want a reimagined police and a different kind of policing. And is this going to end up serving as some sort of microcosm for discussions about other agencies? Or do you think this might have been specific to this agency and specific to the environment fostered at this agency in this city?
So I think in this instance, you see the video and, you know, let's go beyond just the obvious horrific events and things that we witness in the video, moments where Nicholas is prone, he's pinned, and an officer who outweighs him by 60, 70 pounds is hauling off and kicking him in the face like you're kicking a field goal, all right? I mean, those are really, really awful, awful moments and very tough to watch, whether you're a cop or not. As a cop, you know, I go back to the George Floyd thing. Yeah. You know, you find yourself as a cop yelling at the screen, telling Siobhan, let him up, what are you doing? You know, even though you know it's a tape and he can't hear you, you know, you have that impulse. So, you know, I think that in Tennessee and TBI, that's what's going to go on. But I think your point is valid. I think when these things happen, people then start to look outside of the immediate department and that immediate agency, and they start to look at, well, is this something that's going on all over the country? Now, I can tell you here in NYPD, this is already, the issues that are being raised here have already been addressed in the context of a unit called anti-crime. And NYPD has put in strict protocols regarding this sort of a unit. And one of those things is that the tightness of the supervision. And I think that's going to be one of the things that TBI is really going to be looking at hard to see how well supervised was the unit. Had they gone rogue? I mean, consider this.
Yeah.
Look at the name of the unit.
Yeah.
In New York, the units that do what Scorpion does are called anti-crime. You know, what you want them doing is embedded and personified right in the title of the unit. By naming it Scorpion, what does a scorpion do? It stings, well, that, kills you.
But that was an acronym, right? It was an acronym for,
sure,
something.
But what they do is they come up with this name,
sure,
and they figure out a way to reverse engineer an acronym,
sure,
that works, right? So, you know, naming it Scorpion, I think, you know, sort of set the culture from the get-go. Now, it didn't have to, obviously, but nonetheless, it kind of tells you what the mindset was, which was, guys, mm-hmm, get out there. You're the frontline guys. Kick butt and take names, you know? And I think that it developed into a unit that drifts away from the department writ large. It becomes its own little unit, its own little universe, its own little echo chamber. And here, it seems to have gone into a region where this kind of brutality not only was accepted, but celebrated. They left their body cam. I mean, remember, these guys were on body cam.
Yeah.
And even, they know everything they're doing is recorded. And yet they did not have any trepidations about behaving the way they did. That tells me there was no fear of their overhead. Nobody's going to look at the video to say, what are you guys doing?
Oh.
And then afterwards, they're celebrating. You know, they left the body cams on and they're fist bumping and they're having a very sort of celebratory moment. And it just kind of shows you how far off the rails the whole thing seems to have gone.
Paul, you noted in the op-ed you wrote, as have others, that Memphis relaxed its police hiring standards in 2018. They were struggling to recruit. We know that was a theme around the country. This meant, in Memphis's case, less education was required. I'm not seeing much else in the way of relaxed standards, but how significant is that? You know, are we seeing that in other departments? In Memphis's case, do you think that will be a central point to this investigation, that was noted? Or is this just sort of par for the course? If you're having trouble recruiting, you shift.
Well, I think it's a larger issue because policing in general, post-Floyd, but also for a number of reasons, I think as a profession, it just had become a lot less attractive and it was getting hard to recruit. And we're seeing that happen now, all right? The police are having a very hard time keeping the perps they arrest in jail for any length of time with the bail laws and everything else. And just the entire atmosphere and prestige of the job seems to be taking a hit from outside the department. The men and women are still doing the job, but the prestige and the allure, it's become less professionalized, I think, nationwide. And so I'm not surprised to hear that they had that problem in Memphis. And sure, they're going to look at that. They're going to say, are we taking people maybe that we overlooked? There's all kinds of reporting that nationwide, not just here in New York, but nationwide, there are people coming on with criminal records. And they're going to say, like, you know, do we need to raise the standards? But you got to remember something. You want better people, you're going to have to pay for them. I'm sorry, but police work costs money. And sometimes the answer maybe is less is more. So if we're going to say we want more professional folks, we want more training, we want more this, we want that, we have to raise the standards. Well, unfortunately, a big part of raising standards is money.
The reaction's been wide-ranging. Obviously, everyone's horrified, but there are some who say even if these officers were Black, they were still acting under this quote-unquote systemically racist police system in the way they handled Tyree. Others say these were bad apple cops. But I'm wondering, among all the chatter and all the conversation as people try and qualify this, is this more nuanced? Because we are talking about things like the Scorpion unit, relaxed hiring requirements. Are we having sort of the wrong conversation in this case?
You know, I think so. I think that I think a lot of the right conversations are going on.
Yeah.
But the risk with something like this is overreaction. And my gut tells me, my mind tells me, my eyes tell me that this was a unit that went rogue. Their behavior in the video and after the video, that to me is very, very telling. I don't know what happened beforehand, but the video after the fact is really troubling because, as I said, you saw the celebratory mood as if what occurred wasn't a fail, but was a success. And, you know, to do what they did and to be fist bumping each other, to me, speaks of a unit that's really gone out on a limb, that's really drifted away from its core mission. It's been allowed to drift away from its core mission, perhaps because of the way the unit was set up. And to label it as systemic racism, to me, is a reach. This is, to me, a cultural thing that came out of a unit in the police department.
Finally, Paul, very briefly, you noted that the federal civil rights investigation is happening concurrently with all of this, and that's not necessarily typical. That usually happens a little bit afterwards. I think Floyd matter, we saw it happen like immediately afterward.
Yeah, they did, yeah.
But you're worried that might get in the way. Can you just briefly share with us why you think that maybe they should hold off for a second on that?
You know, as an attorney, I've been through this, and concurrent federal and state investigations can get very, very messy. What they'll do is they'll put a firewall between them and make sure that there's no interaction. And so when the defense attorneys start subpoenaing the feds to see what have you gotten, what material are you holding, et cetera, the federal government will say we're a separate sovereign. We're not part of the prosecution of you guys. And so leave us out of this. There'll be all kinds of motions that go back and forth. Is it doable? It is doable. It's just not necessary. It may be necessary later because they feel like TBI didn't get a full scrub or they don't feel like the reforms were enough. But we all know that if the federal government gets involved in this thing, they're not going to look at it and then say, all right, everything was well handled. You know, now we're walking away. They're going to put a monitor in place.
Right.
And miraculously, they continue to discover new things and new things and new things, and they will bleed a city dry. And I'm not so sure it's helpful.
Retired NYPD inspector and attorney Paul Morrow, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Put the power of over 100 meteorologists and the worldwide resources of Fox in your hands with the Fox Weather Podcast. Precise, personal, powerful. Subscribe and listen now at foxnewspodcasts.com or wherever you get your podcasts. Subscribe to this podcast at foxnewspodcasts.com.
It's time for your Fox News commentary.
What's on your mind?
Ronna McDaniel has done it again, edging out the RNC's California National Committee woman Harmeet Dhillon by a vote of 111 committee members to 51 to keep her seat as the RNC chair. And many conservatives, myself included, are wondering how the heck that happened. Ronna did a great job as chair for her first couple of terms, but that pink splash of a red wave last November left many conservatives disheartened, disappointed, and ready for something new. I was shocked to see Ronna beat out Harmeet Dhillon. Harmeet has been in the trenches for many years, fighting the good fight for election integrity and often doing it with little praise or attention. And I would have liked to see her take the seat and be our new RNC warrior. If we keep doing what we're doing on the Republican side, we will keep losing. We can't keep serving the same Ronna soup warmed over and expecting it to taste like victory. I'm Tommy Lahren, and you can watch my show Tommy Lahren is Fearless at Outkick.com.
You've been listening to the Fox News Rundown. And now, stay up to date by subscribing to this podcast at foxnewspodcasts.com. Listen ad-free on Fox News Podcasts Plus on Apple Podcasts. And Prime members can listen to the show ad-free on Amazon Music. And for up-to-the-minute news, go to foxnews.com.
From the Fox News Podcasts Network, Fox News Rewind Financial Crisis 08. A look back at the biggest financial crisis since the Great Depression.
The market is not functioning properly.
Subscribe now at foxnewspodcasts.com. From the Fox News Podcasts Network.
Hey there, it's me, Kennedy. Make sure to check out my podcast, Kennedy Saves the World. It is 5 days a week, every week. Download and listen at foxnewspodcast.com or wherever you listen to your favorite podcast.